Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
July 5th, 2015, episode number 79. All work and some play. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. My name is Kevin England. It's been a full month and 11 days since the recording of our last episode. Many of you have been wondering where I've been and what I've been up to. Some actually have shown concern that bodily harm has come my way, and for those that have written in, I thank you for your well wishes and can assure you I'm perfectly healthy and in reasonable spirits these days. As the title alludes, it's been all work and some play around here, but mostly work. New responsibilities at work and additional workloads have spilled into the personal life, and sometimes reality requires us to prioritize. I can't say that I've been totally consumed by work, as since we've last talked, I had a chance to go with my two brothers to the Pocono race, and we did have that little state meeting that weekend. The weekend after that, I had to fix a broken water pipe in the basement. I was out of town last weekend for a wedding. One of Sharon's co-workers got married and did get out to two of the racing team's race nights the past two Fridays. Yes, time is a blur. In between, work has been long nights and early mornings. A global rollout of an HR system wreaked havoc over last weekend, and a go-live the weekend before that. So no, it hasn't been too stressful lately. As I sit here on this Sunday morning, I'm supposed to be writing a white paper for our team's web and mobile framework for a meeting tomorrow morning, first thing, but decided I needed a break, so I fired up the microphone with the chat to have a chat with you folks. I've actually tried on a few occasions to get something in the bank for an episode, but can never find the time to get anything organized, so forgive me for the organic nature of this episode. Yep, I'm just going to wing it, if you'll indulge me. So no put-together agenda, no formal run-through. Let's just go. Have to start with the local hive report. How the heck do I do that? I don't even know what the local hive report is. Okay, local hive report. In the last part of our journey, we had talked about a frame that I had pulled out, two frames, and put into a nuke to see if they would raise me some queen cells. They had raised a good number of them, and I split that up with some resources out of a donor hive and made a good number of splits. I think it was four or five. Whatever the case may be, that night I had suggested that it was cool, and I was a little concerned about whether or not those splits would actually work. As it turns out, the following night it got down into the 30s. The night after that it was in the 30s, and unfortunately those hives did not have enough bees to keep the queen going, and several of them just didn't make the cut. I think there was a fair number, now that I recall, like seven or eight, maybe even nine, and two of them made it through. So currently what I did is move some of my hives out of my local yard, meaning my literal yard in my home, to the new yard over on the farm that I was able to secure earlier this year. So I have two hives outside, literally on the pads, and the rest of them all got moved over. The two hives outside look great. For whatever reason, the one hive that overwintered with a medium cluster, it has three honey boxes on it and is heavy as can be. The other hive that was a little bit of a slow start but started to get going now has two honey boxes on it, and it too is heavy. So they're stacked up out in the yard, and this is the weekend probably where we want to pull the honey supers off and see how they're doing, check for mites, and do early summer management. July and August is the time to check for mites. If you haven't done so in the spring, please, please, please do it now. The other hive location has one hive that was a swarm capture. I checked it yesterday, and it just doesn't, even though it's on a full field, huge field of clover and other resources, we're into July, and this is the time where the nectar flow and anything else in nature tends to taper off. Ton of activity at the entrance, but the hive doesn't feel heavy to me. I'm going to go over this afternoon. I have to mow that yard, and I'm going to check into how that hive is doing and see what's going on inside. I've been in the mode over the last number of weeks not going in my hives. I disturbed them a lot in the spring just to get them up and running, but my game plan this year was to leave my hives alone and let them be. And that hive, I just want to check and see what it's doing. Another hive that I have over there is in an 8-frame. It was one of the splits that I was talking about. It is light as can be, feather light. I have no idea what's going on. There's a handful of bees coming and going at the entrance. I'm not even sure if the queen is operational in there. I have a nuke in the yard that has the same kind of posture to it. So I'm going to look in those today and see what's going on with them. I didn't feed them because the nectar flow was on. And again, they're sitting out there now on a field that has just acres and acres and acres of wildflower and clover for them. And the clover is up and looks spectacular this year. It really looks good. We've had a fair amount of rain over the last couple of weeks, unlike the early spring when it was dry straight through. And everything looks green and lush. The plants look good. There should be a reasonable amount of forage. Now, I just moved those hives over there last weekend. So maybe they just aren't up and running. They're going to take time to get to the bounty and recover. They were not doing well at all in my yard. The other hive that's over there is the package hive. And I hear from everybody else that their package hives did really well. My package hive is just sitting there, meandering in one box. I'm at a loss to describe why this hive just will not grow. Maybe at the new location it's going to find the proper forage that it requires? I don't know. Again, all of those hives over there probably need a peek to see how they're doing, and I'm going to go in this afternoon. Hopefully the weather will cooperate. So the one side effect of having 2 yards is I have to mow 2 places, and that's been a bit of a burden. I don't particularly like to lift and put a mower in my truck, in my RAV4, so I've been hooking up the trailer. The good news is when I go over there, I can literally drive right in and alongside the hives. So when I dropped them off, it was fairly easy to do, and that's a bonus to it. But the area that I carved was pretty big. To mow it with a hand mower probably takes about 45 minutes. Maybe I should have made it smaller, but my inclination is to claim my space over there so I can put in even more hives as time goes on. So anyway, that's a local hive report. 2 hives in the yard doing very well. 4 hives over at the other location. One of them is a nuke, kind of eh, and really hoping that they get going. If for whatever reason, both the swarm hive and the package hive just don't look like they have stores, I am going to probably feed them. I want to prop them up. I need them to be strong enough to go into winter. The other two, I'll just make general assessments. And I'm thinking at this point, it would be a great time for me to look in my big hives and determine if they have abundant resources that I could potentially make another nuke or two. So that's what I have on my mind. I'm not sure if I'll get to that this weekend. It'll probably be next weekend when I look to harvest the honey. So local hive report, it's a mixed bag. Not sure. I'll know better when I get into my hives this afternoon over at the other location. I'll call it the farm. How's that? Can't think of anything else for the local hive report, so let's close it down and we'll go into segment number one. For segment number one, I want to talk about varroa-tolerant hives. As beekeepers, whether it's top bar, Langstroth, treatment-free, commercial, hobbyist, Ware, national hive, those who treat 10 hives, 1 hive, 1,000 hives, we all have a common enemy. It is the varroa mite. Given the universal disdain for the varroa problem, just about any researcher, hobbyist, commercial beekeeper, and so on, report what it takes to survive as a beekeeper and the approaches, gadgets, advice. It's all plenty and plethora of it out there. There is this common wisdom that given time, bees will somehow learn to adapt, yet we still have no magic bullet. And wouldn't it be great if there was some sort of recipe, a recipe that allowed your bees to figure out how to live with the Varroa mite? Well, I have some such recipe. I've had a notion to cover this topic for a while. Bob Kloss sent me an article from the BeeSource Forum archive about a recipe for how to produce Varroa-tolerant honeybees from locally adapted stock. It was a research article from the Carl Hayden Bee Research Center, and get this, it was printed in the American Bee Journal magazine from the year 2000. 15 years ago, they had a recipe to solve Varroa, so why didn't anybody tell me? So, what I'm about to share is based on a long-term study that started in 1994, and presumably, since it got published in 2000, it ran 6 years since it was in the ABJ issue. It appears this was published in the aspect of, we found success with it, so maybe you could try it and let us know how it goes. Now, this was 15 years ago, and so many things have evolved. Even some of what I read in the article is outmoded, but the foundational principles are strong enough to share, and I think it's really interesting to go through this and think about what it is. It says that in the interest in our approach, it has led us to encourage other beekeepers to try our strategy. So even back then, they weren't sure if this was going to work, but I think they thought they were onto something. Moreover, the strategy needs to be tested in other localities. Therefore, we have set forth our step-by-step procedure as a recipe that every beekeeper can follow to produce his/her own Varroa-tolerant bees, end quote. It furthermore goes on to say the payoff increased in Varroa tolerance should be achieved in 2 years or less and further improved each year thereafter. That is an interesting thing to chew on. In reading what it says, it seems to be a logical approach and is probably still applicable today, which is why Bob forwarded it to me. It could be noted, before I get your hopes up, this premise is predicated on the notion that you have a number of hives at your disposal. It suggests that you start with at least 10 Varroa colonies, and that is after you select the ones for Varroa-resistant traits. For those of us that don't have dozens of hives, guess this leaves us out of the mix. At minimum, it's still an interesting procedure to follow along with. So here's what it says to do in a nutshell. First thing, find Varroa-tolerant hives. You want to find the Varroa-resistant colonies in your yard. They indicated that 3 to 10% of hives are somewhat Varroa-tolerant. That's an interesting note on its own merit, actually. And I'll talk about their methods to select in a moment when I get to how to do the recipe. The second high-level thing to do in a nutshell is create an isolated yard. Once you have source hives to start with, move them to a separate yard, at least 3 to 4 yards from the original location. Presumably, you'll look for a place where those bees won't be infiltrated by bees that are not part of your isolated yard. Don't move them away from your source yard and within grasp of someone else's headaches, right? That doesn't make much sense if you can't keep them isolated from somebody else's mess. You're going to monitor your mites over time. They suggest every 3 months. Graft queens for populating other yards. So obviously, if you're isolating and getting good queens, then you're going to graft so you can spread the wealth. And then mate your grafted queens. Take them out to other apiaries that are mite tolerant. I'm going to get to a moment here where I talk about that strategy, but I'll leave that be for a second. The last thing you'll do is install these great queens in your other apiaries far and wide. And hopefully in a couple of years, you will see great and wonderful wealth from this approach. So I did my best not to interject any of my notions and interpretation in the instructions, but a lot of thoughts were running through my head while reviewing this. I'll refrain again from offering my commentary as much as possible, but cover the more detailed instructions on how to do this from a recipe, and then I'll add some commentary to it. So the first thing you do is find varroa-tolerant colonies in your apiary. And their guidance to do this is this. First of four suggestions, use survivor colonies, ones that you know haven't been treated but overwintered. Or go with feral stock, stuff that's living in nature without treatment. And even colonies that were abandoned for some reason are still out there without human intervention. So think about that. Good colonies that overwintered, we probably do this already. Finding feral colonies, a lot of talk about that. And the other one is, say this guy's been keeping bees for 100 years, something happens to them, they're sitting out in the yard, the family doesn't do anything with them, but yet you go out there and their hives are running and running. That's a gold mine, and you could use those to your advantage. So the other thing you could do is look at your hives internally and determine whether or not they have good potential for varroa. So think about it. Before you go in for your fall treatments, which is just about right now, July, August time frame, you should be treating your bees for mites if you're of that inclination. This is that period where the brood is ramping down, but the mites are still thriving in the colonies. Look for those that have low mites naturally. There's some signs you could look for, too, about a healthy queen, because obviously you want to pick the best of the best of the best. Look for good brood patterns. You want an absence of worker pupae in uncapped cells. So when they find something bad, they perforate the top of the cell, and then somebody yanks the contents of the cell out. As you look across your brood patterns, look for ones that don't have a lot of holes in them. Fewer worker brood cells with mite feces in them. So mites are in there and they leave feces, and you can see them in the bottom of the cell. That's what they're talking about. Few drone brood cells with mites. So every once in a while you could take an uncapping knife and pop some drones out, see if there's all kinds of brood with mites in there. Absence of bees with deformed wings. Few dead mites on the bottom boards. And last but not least, the least reliable, but obviously you don't want to see bees running around with mites on them. Another way you could do this is just literally ignore your yard. Set them up, put them out somewhere, and let them go. And whatever survives in a couple of years, go back and harvest that. Nature takes care of itself. So that was step number one, which was finding varroa-tolerant colonies by observation. Step number two is isolating your colonies from others so you can have less exposure. So simply take your good hives and put them somewhere where they can be in isolation and operate out of the influence of other beekeepers' hives. Step number three is to monitor your mites. In the article, it talks about monitoring the mite ratio per 100 bees. We've covered that a number of occasions here on the podcast, so I won't go through the procedure, but it was interesting to look at what it said back in 2000, where they were sampling the mites and watching them through some sort of screen and counting the mites that fell through onto water. We've moved on to the shaker method with alcohol wash, but it was interesting to see how they counted mites back then. Step number four involves grafting queens and rearing them. Once you've found the queens with the right genetics, graft from them. It suggests in there, and something that we've talked about here, is you could move a frame of eggs and let them make their own. It doesn't produce a large number of queens, however, and the grafting method, you can scoop as many eggs out and make as many grafted queens, and it's more like factory where you can get more of the genetics spread out. When you're talking about this type of approach, that's probably the methodology you want to use if you were going to do a small-scale commercial organization because of the fact that you're going to spread more faster of your genetic material. And then step number five is mating, queen mating in isolation. Take your queens, put them out to some particular area, mate them out. Make sure you couple them with drones. It had a conversation in here that said you would take your drone frames and put them aplenty. And I'm thinking the way that you would do this is if you have a good yard somewhere
with good queens that you have isolated over time, and you're working over a couple years, you're going to want to try and put some drone brood frame in those hives and generate a good number of drones, and then start spreading those around your apiary, so the surrounding area. And then you'll have your own drone stock, and you're going to have a wide number of hives so you're not getting inbreeding. It takes a little bit of thought to go through this whole thing. But in the end, step number six, take your good queens that you're growing that are genetically favorable for Varroa mites and start requeening with other colonies and yards you have, and you'll have a successful program. So let me go to a Kevin moment. I'll talk about some of my thoughts and notions on this. I think, frankly, this is improbable for hobby beekeepers, if that wasn't obvious already. This somewhat echoes the sentiments of popular notions to ramp up to a fair number of hives and endure the losses, but take whatever survives and just keep going from that. That takes effort, time, and money from the beekeeper, and most hobbyists that I know simply want to have a few hives out in the yard. Can't they just survive? And I want to get some honey from them every summer. So I guess you could take this all with a grain of salt, right? Do you want to be that person who has a couple hives out in the yard and you try and nurse them along? Or do you want to see if you can go into this big model that's going to allow you to have a fair number of hives in multiple yards, but you'll be sustainable and eventually you'll get to a point where your queens are genetically good and you don't have to treat? That's a very interesting notion to think about. This has been mulling around in my brain lately over the last 2 years. You've heard me say I wanted a second yard and I'm thinking about a third yard. I'm thinking about it this way now, though. I have a new idea on this. It is not practical, and my wife will not tolerate me having 1,000 hives out amongst the world. It's just going to become a full-time job, and I'm not interested in that. But perhaps you could do this through cooperation, and many hands make a light load. One could go in together with a joint bee yard and a few hives of yours and a few hives of others and whatever, and instead of having 30, 40, 50, 80, 100 hives of your own, it would be a cooperation yard where you would work to select your genetics and do it that way. The case there being that you're in with a bunch of different beekeepers who have a number of yards, and now you can have isolation yards, right? Because I have a yard, and they have a yard, and the other person has a yard. You put one central yard together. You work on the Varroa selections, and then you take the good stock and you move it out to your local yards, and then they tell two friends, and they tell two friends, and you start genetically controlling. And that's such a misnomer, genetic. Bees are bees. They're going to do whatever they can. But the one notion I heard from David Tarpey in the past is your queen flies out. She will fly farther than any of the drones in her local colony area, because of the fact that she doesn't want to mate with them. That would be inbreeding. So she flies farther out and is mating with somebody else's drones. So part of this is you'd really have to control a wide swath in order to seed these genetics if you're doing it. And in hearing what they're doing down in Virginia or wherever it was, this is kind of the notion. Somebody's already thought of this, by the way. This is not a new concept, but I'm just bringing it here because I don't know that we've ever talked about it. Of spreading this genetic stock across the region. And if you can get a seeded area of Varroa tolerant amongst you and your neighbors, that's an interesting idea. So this is a notion that I'm going to bring up in the July. Just food for thought, right, to some of our beekeepers in our July association meeting. And maybe a bunch of us in Hunterdon and Warren County, where we're from, could conceivably try this. Now, if you don't get everybody in on it, and by the way, we don't control, there's dozens of hive sites around my property that I have, I don't know if they're in our association or whatever. I'm getting to the notion of this. this is not going to happen in New Jersey. It's not, because if you did a 5-mile circle at any given point across the entire state, you'd probably run across 2 or 3 yards that have bees in them. That's my speculation. I probably could ask Tim Schuler about that, but I bet I'm right. Now, if I were in Wyoming or Montana or Colorado or someplace like that, somewhere in Indiana, maybe. Maybe Ohio. Maybe Virginia in the mountains. This is possible to do a region. But in New Jersey proper, where the population density is just spectacular, I don't know if this is fool's errand. I'm just putting it out there for you to think about and to contemplate for your particular area and maybe for New Jersey, as we could take this to the state level if we were so inclined to get excited about this idea. So it's an interesting game plan, one that under the right circumstances could be pulled off, and I have to wonder if some of these magic places that I've heard of that are mite-free and treatment-free have, to some extent, by good beekeeper intervention or just serendipity of good stock, done some sort of approach like this and have succeeded. I don't know D. Lusby whatsoever. I have no idea what the beekeeping practices are, but I do know that that region is known for what D has been doing with her bees, right? That's a folklore thing that people in New Jersey know about, right? So, there's other areas of beekeepers across that I've heard of, and I'm just wondering if maybe they perhaps have taken this notion to some sort of practice. So I'll offer that I very much summarize this approach. There's a bit more to it, and I don't know that I could have gone to explicit detail in this forum. If you're interested in reading it and reading it for more meaning, please feel free to check out our show notes for a link to the whole article. The article reference that I shared was courtesy of Bob Kloss. Bob found it on the Bee Source Forum under the Resources section. If you want to go there directly, you could check out Resources at Bee Source. Go to USDA and then find the article Producing Varroa Tolerant Honeybees from Locally Adopted Stock, a Recipe. I'm sure if you Google or Bing that phrase, you'll find it too. For our show notes and other information related to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast, you can visit bkcorner.org. The show notes are listed by episode. This is episode number 79. You also have any ideas or thoughts to share, friendly in nature, about this? You can send me an email, kevin@bkcorner.org. So for this episode, only had one segment prepared. The rest of it is going to be the back of the book roundtable. Have a number of topics to run through here. The first one is an article that came out May 28th, U.S. EPA proposing temporary pesticide-free zones for honeybees. This was reported out of Reuters. The U.S. environmental regulators proposed a rule that would create temporary pesticide-free zones to protect commercial honeybees. The restrictions are aimed at protecting bees from, quote, pesticides that are acutely toxic, unquote. It would cover foliar applications when certain plants are in bloom and when commercial honeybees are being used to pollinate the crops, says the EPA. It's an 18-page outline for the rule. And in foliar, as we know, it's applied to the leaves of the plants. There's a lot of criticism out there about this, that they have not taken the next step, which is to ban the poison seeds, which are covered with neonicotinoids. And we know that the White House has formed a task force to study the issue, and the EPA is looking into their methods of testing and things in related to this area. It's interesting that the White House and specifically the government have now taken a vested interest in this. Will it cause the EPA to change their ways? I'm not looking to get into a political sojourn for this, just commenting that the first salvo from the EPA to ban this when bees are present is a welcome one. And if you start looking at what's happening specifically in EMEA and Europe, they've already taken a number of steps and seen results, although nobody's definitively come back and said conclusively this is going to solve the problem. But, you know, preliminary data over there is that it's actually working, and you have to wonder whether or not the EPA is finally going to stick their head up and look around and say, this is some steps we need to take against some of these pesticide practices. Not necessarily pesticides are evil, but how they're being deployed is probably more important. So you have the beekeepers on one hand talking about pesticides, but Bayer, Syngenta, and other chemical companies are indicating it's really about the mites. And as we said, the White House is looking at chemical-specific risk assessment for bees. So we'll see how this plays out, but interesting article to find. That's roundtable segment number one. Roundtable number two, wanted to talk about a gadget called a manipulation cloth. I've only seen these for sale, and they've been out of stock at Brushy Mountain Bee Farm. If you go to beekeeping supplies and look in beekeeping tools, you'll find this device. It runs about $20. It's a canvas cloth with a couple metal rods and a metal loop. And the premise of this is you drape it over top of a hive, and it allows you access to two frames at a time that you can pull out and inspect, but it keeps the rest of the hive covered and dark. It's similar in notion to the cloth that Billy Davis said when he was talking about his quiet box, and he's using shades, window shades, that he drapes over the hives. I was exposed to this by a beekeeper in our association who bought one. I saw it in his yard when I went to go check out his bees with him, and we shot a short video of it, and I'm going to go into a Kevin moment here. Why are there trolls out in this world, right? We put this video out there for people to see, and the premise of it was so that you could see this thing, and if you were interested, you could go look into it. I had him do a short demo and describe what it was and how it works. The immediate response on YouTube were for people who commented that it's a waste of money. You can get anybody to separate their money from whatever. I don't understand the behavior of people that way. If you don't have anything nice to say, shut up. That's the way I feel about it. It just frustrates the crap out of me. Sorry for the language. It just really is annoying that people behave this way. You could say that I'm not sure I would use it, but it's an interesting device, and you can show your disdain for it, whatever the case may be, but don't come out and call somebody an idiot. You know, the guy's a brand new beekeeper that showed me this, and I didn't call him an idiot. I thought it was actually pretty neat. We do the Gadget Garage, and I actually think when this comes back in stock, I will buy one and try it. And that's the key. If you're going to be a troll and comment about this, you better have some good reason to tell me why that I shouldn't use this. Otherwise, it's my opinion, or whatever the case may be. I'm entitled to do what I want. I'm the beekeeper. If you don't like it, good for you. Just keep your mouth closed. Now, if there's something dangerous about it, and this was a valid comment on the blog, is that suppose it's spreading germs from one hive to another. I'm making that up, right? It could technically... People say remove your gloves and clean your hive tool when you go from yard to yard, not to spread disease. If you're carrying this thing out and it is physically making contact with every hive, then maybe that's not a good idea. Okay, I'll give some notion to that. But I'm frequently interchanging frames from one hive to another, and I'm not as hygienic as some people want to be about this stuff, so I don't know if I could be too fussy about that. I don't have 18 hive tools. And sometimes I clean my hive tool, you know, I stick it in the dirt and do whatever with it, but I don't know. Anyway, this thing's kind of neat, I think. If you want to take a look at it, go to Brushy Mountain and check it out. It's been out of stock. I'm not sure when they're going to bring it back, but we also shot a video, of, as I said, on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/NWNJBA. You can go check that out. Roundtable number three is about another piece of equipment. This thing's called a butane universal bee smoker. It's some sort of contraption that I saw a picture of somewhere on eBay. I don't know where this thing is or what it does, but that's really my question. Let me see if I can describe it to you. It looks like it's made out of flat metal stock, and it's custom made. It's got a big hoop on the bottom to create the base, and it's got this articulating arm with this barrel contraption that has fittings down to some sort of coupling that it looks like you can take a butane container and screw it into, and it's got hoses and pipes and some little bottle with a hose going into it that's mounted there. And I looked at this thing and I can't figure out what it is or why would you use it and how you would use it. It's a bee smoker. So is this one of those things that you use to fog something? I don't see how that works, but maybe that's true. And that's my guess. My guess is this thing is used to fog hives with something, but being big and bulky and whatever it is, it seems unrealistic or not pragmatic to take it out and be, you know, taking it from hive to hive to hive. So what the heck is this thing? Anybody ever hear of a butane universal bee smoker? Let me know. I'm curious. If you want to see what this thing looks like, type in butane universal bee smoker beekeeping dash HD-538. You'll come up with a website. I hit Common Sense Beekeeping. I don't know what this thing is. And it shows a picture of it. The cost of this thing is $99.95. You could buy it right now. Don't know. It was offered on eBay. My guess is I don't think it's actually available for sale. But if you go to eBay.com, you can see it. They sold one. They have 10 available. There's a couple pictures of it. Just curious if anybody knows what this is. Actually, you'd probably be better off to search for it on eBay. You will find it. Roundtable number 4. This is about setting a world record by covering with 1.1 million bees. This topic came up recently in our association when Stan Wazatowski was talking about how he had participated once in putting bees together to break the world record with someone. And they actually broke the world record for a couple hours and then were superseded and did not get into the Guinness Book of World Records. This article, which came out about late May 2015, a person in China covered himself with 1.1 million bees weighing 240 pounds. He was covered from head to toe. And what's interesting is there was a picture of him prior to getting him set up where he was wrapped in what I'll describe looks like a tree with Christmas lights. It was wrapped all the way around his limbs and his trunk, and it had every couple of inches a queen. And apparently they slathered this guy with honey, and there were just bees everywhere. Thick, huge mound of bees over top of this guy. And they had a number of beekeepers around him. They all had veils, and they were draped with bees. And there were a bazillion bees, and as you could expect, every once in a while you come across this, but this was hugely extreme. He was smoking a cigarette, so the only part of his body that you could see was this round circle about 3 inches in diameter around his mouth where the cigarette was, and he kept seeing a beekeeper reach up and reach under his nose and swipe the bees off so that he could breathe in through his nose. In the news account, it indicates that he did break the record, and he was stung some 2,000 times in the account of it. Wow. I'd be interested in doing a bee beard someday and something interesting like this, but this is just over the top. We'll put a video in our show notes so you can go take a look at this. It's something you do have to see. It's a once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing. I have one last thing to add about this, is that all the beekeepers that were working with him were in full garment, head to toe. Actually, some of them looks like they had jeans on or whatever, but their bee suits were camouflage, and their hats were camouflage. They're so cool. I want one of those. You're supposed to wear white. I wonder if the bees would take well to that, but the bee suits, check them out. They're so cool. I'm going to have to look for that. They look like they had half jackets and full bee suits, and they were all camo patterns. Yeah, that's pretty neat. Roundtable number 5, this one has to do with ley lines. Ley lines is spelled L-E-Y, ley. there are certain lines within the earth that have some sort of resonance to them. I don't want to use the word magnetic or something like that, but this was covered in the past by us. And there's an article on Dave Cushman's site, Dave-Cushman, C-U-S-H-M-A-N.net, about ley lines. This site is an homage to Dave, who's no longer with us. But there's a lot of resources like this. We've talked about the George Emery Pink Pages, which is a similar resource of just a plethora of beekeeping topics. Anyway, in the BKA, British Beekeepers Association, I think it is, Herefordshire, that sounds very British, there was an article in the past about one of their people who was an association president or whatever, sorry, I'm not doing a great job at relaying this, who believed in ley lines, and they were talking about how to collect swarms or find feral hives. And there is a belief in this world that the bees are associated to this, and we humans cannot understand the sense of a ley line or the spectrum or the magnet resonance, whatever it is that is there. The interesting article says that if you could find these ley lines and trace them through a field, you will eventually come upon the bees, as they have a preference to this. I recall a podcast at one point done by Phil Chandler about a woman who talked about this, and she was seemed a little like Luna from the Harry Potter series, a little interesting in her approach, but believed wholeheartedly that these ley lines were something that had to do with the way that the earth operates. I think about the number of occasions you come across people who have these notions and ideas. When I was on a beekeeping episode that we talked about on a garden show of a local radio station, the person who was working with us, I think I'd mentioned this on the podcast, was talking about lines and coming together and karma and all that stuff. I can't say I'm into zodiac symbols or some of this, but there probably is some sort of resonance to this. And more closer to this is the notion that Dave Tarpey had about the way that the drone congregation area works. During our beekeeping meeting in Basking Ridge just recently, we flew the balloon to try and capture drones and see if we can find a drone congregation area. And what he explained to us was that you don't just put a balloon up and drones fly to the scent of the queen. You have to walk around and literally fish with them. And the way that you do this typically is you'll find drone congregation areas where you find a hedgerow or a tree line running through a field, and it intersects with another one and forms a corner. Something about the way the air moves is a notion that it creates this vortice, and the bees get inside that, and that's where the drone congregation areas are. So we walked the balloon around the property. There was a long run of pine trees in the back that met with something. And, you know, as we walked it around the property, we couldn't find any drones. But as soon as we got back in that corner, darn if we didn't find a couple. So I think physical structures and maybe magnetic resonance, who knows. I do believe in some of this is the fact that they have these high-tension power lines, the big, tall towers that run across. And I've mentioned that on the show here, too, is I don't think our bees are flying across those. So, interesting. If you're interested in this, it's dave-cushman.net/b/leylines.html. You can read up on it. And leylines is leylines.html. They go through a situation where someone found some bees in a barn and talk about the dynamics of why they're all situated there. And there is a conclusion somewhere in there that it could potentially have something to do with ley lines. I've always thought this a neat topic and something to keep in mind when you're thinking about where you're placing your bees. People do say that sometimes bees do extremely well if you can figure out where these ley lines are and set your apiary up on them. I will say that this reminds me of divining rods, where people try to find water. And something I saw recently on TV where they set all these water things up and sent somebody out with divining rods, didn't tell them where they were, and nobody was successful in finding them. the divining rods just didn't work. But I've also seen somebody come into my yard when I owned my previous house trying to find the septic system and whatever with divining yards. And I don't know if it was reading the lay of the land or whatever, but he found the tank and it was underground and nobody knew it was there. Nobody knew this tank was there. It was there from the 20s. And he walked around the yard with his divining yards and found it. We dug and darn if it wasn't right there. So there's got to be a little something to all of this. Again, you could check this out. We'll have it in our show notes. dave-cushman.net/b/leylines.html. Roundtable number 6. Let's get to some listener mail and we'll close this out. First one comes from Charles Klein. He's listening to all my episodes, and he's not very happy with my Apple bashing. Sorry, Charles, didn't mean to offend you. I know a lot of people are very passionate about their Apple products. I recently got a new iPad from work and have been trying to make friends with it. I'll just leave it at that. I'm not going to bash it. Something they did recently at work has really been like just shaking my head. They're going to break all our applications. It's not that I don't appreciate people's ability to make choice. It's just the fact that they make my life in the enterprise very frustrating and they're not very cooperative. But I could recognize Apple for the good services that they have and for the great equipment and apps and all those other things. So there you go, Charles. I'll give you a call out that... Yeah, I know Apple's got a lot going on. Maybe my frustration of dealing with them in the enterprise comes out a little too much. I'll tone that down a little bit. There was a commentary about the Flow Hive in your email also. I'm interested in seeing one. I know a lot of people have reservations, but at the end of the day, to me, it's just another way of keeping bees, and I'm fascinated to find out how it actually works. This whole notion of the Flow Hive is kind of quieted down. I haven't heard anything. I'm wondering if they're shipping product. I'll have to take a mental note to go back and take a look at that and see how it works. I know some people in our association have said that they were going to try it out. So I'll have to ask in our July meeting if anybody picked one up, if they're shipping. Appreciate the email. Thanks for writing in. I could add, you also wrote in about another email about hive wrapping and the reason you put entrance reducers up in the winter. It had to do with dead bees piling up and being able to clear them out. Yep, that, I agree with your note there. You want to have your entrance reducer down on the floor so that the bees can drag them out. Although Bob Kloss and I were having a conversation this past week, he got a message from somebody asking more about our... robbing screens that he came up with or somebody came up with that we made. One of the questions was, if you have the robbing screens that block the entrance down through to the floor, how do they clear out their dead bees? Well, my notion and his notion were the same, that they can literally fly straight up and carrying them out. So even if you have a robbing screen blocking that entrance, they will come out and through that space available, fly up vertically and then out horizontally and deposit the dead bees out away from the hive. So that was an interesting question, one that you haven't thought of. But the fact of the matter is they're pretty resourceful. And if you think about dead bees in a hive, in a tree, the hole is not at the top. The hole is probably somewhere in the middle of the entrance. And they'll fly from the bottom of the hive up and out through the hole. So they must apparently be adept in nature to be able to do these things. The next one is not necessarily a listener mail, but more of a comment that came through from iTunes. My friend Gary from Kiwibana, he keeps track of comments that are coming through iTunes. This one came out recently. I'm new to BK Corner and beekeeping. It is so full of non-biased information and useful tips. I listen to it when I'm driving to work and have... to save it often so I can jot down information from the show that came through 2 days ago. So I appreciate commentary on iTunes, favorable or not. It's good for us also to keep our show up in the top when people are looking for beekeeping resources. The more comments it has, the better it gets rated favorably in iTunes. So if you have the opportunity and the inclination, please, if you're new, go ahead and give us. I don't typically ask for plugs, but in this case, it's more about giving the ability for people to find beekeeping podcasts. The ranking algorithm keeps us from being obscure in there, and people can find us. So thanks for that comment in iTunes. We very much appreciate that. Nick Jordan is a loyal listener. He sends in emails occasionally. Just keep us posted of the things that he finds. He sent me a bee film on solitary bees. It was shot. I watched it the other morning. I woke up for whatever reason. I had gone to bed at midnight, and all the stuff from work was rolling through my head. And I woke up at 3 in the morning and could not go to sleep. The 3 hours sleep that night was not a good day the next day. But one of the things I did is came down and read the email from Nick and clicked on the Vimeo and watched this video in the middle of the night. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, Nick, I agree with you. It was a stunning film, amazing photography. We'll put a link to it in the show notes as the link's a little bit too long. But if you get a chance to look at this, it's a pretty cool little documentary. Great close-ups and flying segments and stuff with a nice narrative that kind of explains what's going on. So thanks, Nick, for sending that over. I seem to recall there was something else from Nick, but seem to have lost track of it. So we'll see if I can dig that up. Something else that came through. Got an email from Elaine Bayer asking for the BK Corner inspection form. Where do you find it? Elaine, you could go to our homepage on the right-hand side. It's kind of nestled in there between the picture of getting started and the beekeeping stand. You'll find a link to the form. It's in a Word document. You could save it off to a PDF and print it. She says, love your podcast. Listen to them while I'm quilting and woodworking in the garage. Build my own beekeeping equipment. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Elaine. She's from Mill City, Oregon, and she sent it from her iPad. So we know there's a bunch of you out there using your Apple products to access us. This next email comes from Dale Peru. Dale, don't know how to say your last name. P-E-Y-R-O-U-X. You come from Hammond, Louisiana. I've really enjoyed your podcast. I started at the beekeeping, and I am only up to podcast 17. I had an observation hive at work about 15 years ago and really enjoyed it, apparently until they swarmed. He has no bees this time around, but he's going to try a cutout tomorrow. He sent this message over on June 30th, so I'm wondering how that had to work. He made a comment about some of our first episodes, and I had forgotten about this. We had mixed some music in to try and give it a little bit of vibe, and I was always giving information about who the artists were, and the commentary from me and from some others were that this just got in the way, and we simplified things. It made less production value, I suppose, but it also made it easier and more to the point to eliminate the music. And I agree with you, Dale. They're better for not having it. Thanks for taking the time to write in. Really appreciate the comments, and let us know how you made out with that cutout. Next listener mail comes in from Stan Whitney. The subject of it was distinctive voice. He indicates that one of his good friends down there in Florida was a New Jersey transplant and wondered if that person was related to me. Don't think I know anybody down there, Stan. My father is down in Florida in Okeechobee. Is that where? Is that what you're doing? I don't have any relatives in Tallahassee, though. But I do plan maybe to come down there someday and call it a place to live. We'll see. So he says he enjoys the podcast. He's in the newbie realm, and he plans to get started next spring. Thanks, Stan, for writing in, and good luck. Keep posted with us and let us know how you make out if you join the fray. And I like his picture. It has a picture of Neo from The Matrix with spots all over it. I don't know if those are bees or just his suit, but again, thanks for taking the time to write in. Another listener email came from Chris Toftenberg. Just wanted to say he appreciates the podcast. He's been keeping bees for about 5 years, it looks like. He had decent years, but nothing of the glory years that he's heard of. Mostly bad years. That sounds familiar. He's got some struggling colonies and unacceptable losses. He said, how the heck do you lose a colony in May? I have to agree with you. Maybe, Chris, you want to look for better nutrition and value in land like I'm doing. I keep doing the same thing and not having great results, so I'm making a change this year. And that's the encouragement that I would give everybody else, is just look at your situation, be honest about it, ask your state apiarist and get an assessment, and then make the right moves and take action on that. That's my guidance there. Not that you asked for it, but just reflecting on what I'm doing around here. So, Chris, keep up the good work. Try and keep your head up, and thanks for writing in. We appreciate that. Good luck to you. Keep us posted on how you're doing. And let us know if you make changes and how that works out for you. One last one to share, a note of encouragement. This one comes from Rebecca Taylor from Grantsville, West Virginia. Said, I've been meaning for months to write you to say thanks for all the BK Corner podcasts. I'm a new beekeeper, and I've learned so much from listening to your show as I drive to and from to work. She indicates she has an hour-plus commute. Ouch. She said, I know you're crazy busy with work and WNJBA, so thanks for making the time for the show when you can. I like the fact that people listen during their drive to work. It's a great time to listen. I listen to podcasts and audiobooks on that time frame. I've found this zen of being able to stay focused on my driving, but yet tune in a singular topic. It's kind of like listening to somebody talk in a car, but at least the topic is straightforward. And I find myself listening to podcasts and wandering off on different ideas and not actually hearing what's going on. I was listening to Solomon Parker the other day, and him talking about his expansion model beekeeping, and it got me to thinking about a bunch of different things. It brought me back to the article that was in segment number one. I appreciate you writing in, Rebecca, and agree with you. The drive time is some of the best time to listen to podcasts, and we're glad you put our show in your mix. I got one more topic that I wanted to throw in here, and it's about a bug called an earwig. I remember when I was a kid, we used to have these in the house when I lived in Flemington. And I always hate them. They creeped me out. They're long bugs with big pinchers on the end. And we always called them pincher bugs. They like moisture for whatever reason. And there was a question on a beekeeping forum recently about earwigs and whether or not they're harmful to bees. In a quick reference guide to honeybee parasites, pest predators, and diseases from Penn State, it indicates beehives provide shelter to a number of large and small arthropods, such as spiders, earwigs, and cockroaches. They're not harmful to the bees or hive equipment and do not require control. I know in times that I've talked to people about this just generally, and one of the things that they say is they could potentially have something to do with cleaning of mites and spiders and other things in there, and that they like the moisture of the hive. I see it as a bad thing because if you have moisture in your hive and they're not able to evacuate it and it makes a moist environment for earwigs, then maybe you want to consider ventilating your hive better. But fact of the matter is when I go out and look at my hive sitting out along the sides of the woods, I find ants in them and other things. It's just nature, right? If you have a wood pile, you're going to find critters in it. And if you have beehives and they have a roof and they have an area where they can find shelter from the rain and possible food sources, I think it keeps the bees occupied up top, trying to keep any of these things out of the hive, especially when you have a large colony of ants. But for the most part, as it said, spiders, earwigs, cockroaches, they're all generally not a problem for the hives. There was a notion about this in the Mid-Atlantic Apicultural Research and Extension Pests of Honeybees brochure. This is what it had to say about roaches, earwigs, etc. There are several types of insects that may live for shorter or longer periods of time inside beehives or inside the inner cover of a beehive. Roaches and earwigs are two good examples. Most of them do no detectable harm, although the beekeeper may feel their presence as unsanitary or unsightly. Some may eat honeybees or honey, while others are just there for the shelter.
I seem to find this more of a problem when you have your stuff stacked somewhere in a garage. And it indicates stacking stored equipment in closed stacks and fumigating the stacks with PDB will keep most insects out of the stored equipment. I'm not sure how old that is, but I believe PDB stands for a product that you would find in mothballs. And as I look it up, paradichlorobenzene is what PDB stands for from an acronym. And I seem to recall that when we've talked about this in the past, mothballs with this product are considered a carcinogen, and you don't want to use it. So if that's an old guide, don't follow it. You could look for moth flakes or something made with materials, do your research, that are not cancer-causing. That sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? But anyway, what it's saying is use some sort of fumigant to do it. I know in the past I have moth flakes that you can buy from a beekeeping supply house, so you make sure you get the right one and not the methyl ethyl death stuff that your grandmother used to put inside your clothes hampers to keep the moths from eating the wool. And if you put those in the stack and close them off and follow the directions, they'll keep things from eating them. I don't recall that it would be a good idea to put those on your beehives, but when you pull your stuff out and have them stacked somewhere, what do you do to keep the critters out of them? That's one idea. So one last notion on this. Michigan State University Extension had some information about earwigs. So by the way, I found this on BeeSource Forum. Someone put it together. Thank you, whoever posted that out there. They're omnivorous. They will consume algae, fungi, mosses, pollen, insects, spiders, and mites, dead or alive. Earwigs consume mites. It says earwigs may damage flowers, vegetables, fruits, foliage of ornamental trees and shrubs, and even honey in beehives. Fortunately, the damage by earwigs is generally much less severe than would be expected by the actual concentration of earwigs present. Mites in hives. They eat mites in hives. Did you hear that? Okay, I'm going to leave with that notion. They eat mites in hives. I heard that somewhere. That's very fascinating to me. Yeah. Anyway, a good question about earwigs and ants and other things that you find. Generally, they're not a problem. If you have your hives up off the ground, and you should, you could use something like Tanglefoot or other contraptions to keep them from crawling up. And given that earwigs do not fly, you can keep them out that way. Some people use oil reservoirs where they have to cross some form of liquid in order to get to the leg to crawl up into the hive. So if they do skeeve you out, or you have a lot of spiders building underneath and you're finding cocoons, or you have ants that just won't particularly leave you alone, you can look in the bee catalogs for some solutions that are available commercially, or you can figure out some sort of contraption on your own. So let's call a close to the earwig thing. Let me look and see if I have anything more on the pile real quick. So actually, there is one more thing I want to throw in here before we close out. And I want to just do a quick summary of the June 6th NJBA meeting that our association hosted up in Basking Ridge. It was a funny morning. It started to rain that morning. It rained on the drive up there. And as we pulled into the driveway, the clouds broke and opened up and allowed us to have a perfect weather day. David Tarpey was the featured speaker. He spoke twice during the day, and also Mr. Tim Schuler, the state apiarist for New Jersey, gave the apiarist report, talked about the winter death loss. We shot video of those two things. We're going to have to get those produced and put them up on our YouTube channel. David was gracious enough to say, yes, we could put his coverage out there. And given that we've been so busy not to be able to put the podcast together, we haven't been able to produce the videos yet either. But I think
as summer progresses, I'll get a little bit of more time. The good news for me is that soccer is over during that stretch, so I have some of my Sundays free, at least until September. So the day went off perfectly. Registration was great. We were really a little worried a week ahead of time. A typical attendance for these is about 100, 120 people. We were only at 80 people. We did a campaign to see if we could draw some more people in by raising awareness, and it worked out perfectly. At the end of the day, I think we had 180 people, one of the bigger meetings, if not the biggest that I've ever attended at the state level. I remember Dave saying he was surprised at the number of people in the audience. And that must mean something, as he travels all over the place. Anyway, the day went off perfectly. I mean perfect. Not a single problem all the way through, from registration to breakfast to parking to the talks. We went outside and did the demonstration stations. The vendors were loaded all day long. They did a significant amount of business. Good for them. And I have to say the drone, the fishing for drone weather balloon thing was great. Stan Wazatowski was able to get us a small helium tank, and we flew the netting. And while we didn't attract a bazillion drones, we did find some. And just, it was worth the price of admission to watch Charlie Ilsley running around with the fishing pole. He's just a hoot. The bees that we brought up worked perfectly. Bob Kloss and I, the week of the meeting, went up on Tuesday evening and transported the bees out of our mentoring yard up to Basking Ridge. We now have a badge to say that we're migratory beekeepers. We transported hives in a manner that required it. We could do pollination contracts. We were joking. It was just a lot of fun. It was a lot of work, don't get me wrong. But what was great was the morning of, when we showed up early in the morning, the Northwest Association members came out in droves, and from parking to registration to set up to moving equipment and bringing in drinks, and the catering was just incredible. Everybody was really excited. That is, by the way, the number one thing to have a successful meeting. Forget the speaker, forget the vendors and the lot. If you serve them good food, they'll think the meeting was great. We hit all of the notes. We were really excited about that. And we were really worn out by the end of the day, make no mistake. But we left there and went and got a nice dinner. Went to a little Italian restaurant, ordered some pizzas, ordered some other stuff. And then we went over to Melavino and got to sit in with Sergio and try some mead, new products coming out with Sergio. Very excited to see he's still doing well. Great hospitality there. David was very happy and bought a number of bottles to take back to his sisters and with him. Jenna Katz, the association president at the state level, joined us, and we really had a good evening there, and it was the perfect end to a long but fruitful day. And the feedback from all those in attendance was just spectacular. Everybody really enjoyed themselves. The sessions were very informative. The hands-on went great. From the two hives that we have, David Wazatowski did the splits hive presentation, and he pulled the frames out. Those hives look great from our mentoring yards. And he pulled it right out, found the queen, was able to isolate her and give a good demonstration, and people were really excited about that. And just in general, the Gadget Garage was another hit. Bob and I had brought all our stuff, and there wasn't enough room on the table for all the things, and people were really excited to go through all the toys and fun things there. So if you're a Northwester listening to this, thank you for all the participation and hard work there. Thanks to the executive crew and to the participation from the state in helping us in support of the meeting. One other thing that's coming up is the Eastern Apiculture Society is in Canada this year, but next year it's being hosted in New Jersey. And the New Jersey Beekeepers Association, along with the branches, will be facilitating the meeting. And it's going to be a spectacular amount of work. But we're really excited to have it in New Jersey and excited to be the hosts and showcase this. We'll do whatever we can to support Jeff Bird, who's one of the principals at the state level trying to organize this. And if you're in New Jersey, please, or the tri-state area or the East Coast, come support the NJBA meetings and or the Eastern Apiculture Society. You won't regret it. So with that, I guess it's time to close down this episode. I'll remind you once again, for the show notes, visit www.bkcorner.org. You can write in any notes just to say hi, tell me what you have going on, ask a question, whatever it may be, at kevin@bkcorner.org. And I'll leave you with this. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody, and be well.